It's time for another Internet Advisor Show podcast. Since 1998, we've been helping computer users get on the Internet, get around it, and get over the problems they encounter there. The Internet Advisor is a two-hour weekly radio program heard on WJR 760 AM in Detroit since 1998 and across the state of Michigan on the Michigan Talk Network. Now, here are your hosts with this week's Internet Advisor podcast.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor, your place for answers to your computer questions since 1998, with your co-hosts Gary Baker and Foster Brown and their team of tech experts. The door is always open at InternetAdvisor.net, on Facebook, and through Twitter. But right now it's time to get you in touch with your helpful hosts on this week's edition of Internet Advisor.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor. Hi, I'm Foster Brown, co-host of the program, along with Mr. Gary Baker and Ed Rudell today. We're going to be handling a red-hot topic, which is net neutrality. A big fight is brewing in the FCC when they're going to be laying down some rules about whether this is going to be an open Internet or not, and just how they're going to work that out in the month of February. Craig Backus with us from the Free Press. We'll also be talking about some of the incredible things going on at the show and answering some of your questions. Welcome to our second show of the brand new year, or is this the third one? I forget. I'm losing count.
My second. Your third.
My third. Hi, I'm Foster Brown, the co-host, and sounds pretty confused, the Internet Advisor, along with Mr. Ed Rudell. We've done so many of these things. It's 17 years of these things we've been doing that I sometimes lose a little bit of track. Ed is with me here in studio. Gary is going to be in here in just a little bit. This is our network version of the program. Well, what that means is that there are times when we are preempted by sports on our home station, WJR in Detroit, but the show must go on, and every week we have 2 hours of the Internet Advisor for your pleasure and to help you. And so I'm glad that you found a way of finding our program, and you can always find out more about the program by going to InternetAdvisor.net. But Ed, it's good to see you here. You've made it through the cold.
I did, and I'm enjoying this little bit of a reprieve from the snow and ice.
You're right. It's a little bit of a reprieve because in Michigan, at least, where we are based, it could be winter for quite a while more, or even into April at times we've experienced.
You know what I've really enjoyed is I discovered on the Grand Valley website, both my children go there, and they're both adults, really, but and I've really enjoyed watching the webcams over there in Grand Rapids, and just the torrents of snow that just falls down there, and this kids all huddled over, some of them running around in shorts, though. Do you remember when you were that young?
Yes, I've seen these kids in downtown Royal Oak doing the same thing.
3 foot of snow running around
webcam,
in shorts.
That webcam gives a new meaning to POS, parent over shoulder. Oh boy. Well, today we're going to be looking at the whole battle about net neutrality, and we're going to be talking in just a little bit with Craig Aaron from freepress.net, a fascinating site, and I think you're going to really enjoy the conversation because it's going to get down to a real hot battle, not a cold war, but a hot one coming up this next month in February when the FCC makes some rules on that. But before we get there, of course, we like to check in with our old buddy, Mr. Mike Brennan, and to have him dish a few of his headlines from MI Tech News. Mike, thanks so much for joining us again this week.
Always a pleasure, Foster.
And you got enough of the sand out of your shoes. Your tan has begun to fade.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, the memory
is
very
depressing. Very depressing, yes.
At least you had the memory of the sun. Mike just came back from his vacation. Well, Mike is the editor, has been for a long time, of MI Tech News, and it's a place now it's really growing. It's not just the headlines about technology and about entrepreneurship in the state of Michigan and around the country, but now, Mike, you've been gathering some video elements and some audio elements as well, and we'll talk a little bit about that in just a moment, but why don't we give them a little bit of a smorgasbord of the kind of headlines that you've got out there right now. Let's see, our governor of the state, who is limping around right now, Governor Snyder has signed a bill requiring Amazon and other online companies to collect sales tax.
Oh, no!
Oh, no!
Well, that's a good thing. And he's also getting pushback from the very conservative legislature who are saying, oh, my gosh, you're raising taxes. What he's trying to do is level the playing field, because if you buy from Amazon versus buying from a Michigan store, you don't pay the 6% sales tax with Amazon, whereas, of course, if you buy locally, you do. Right. So he's just, and this is a big movement going around for a lot of states around the country, and he thinks this might do as much as $100 million a year, and, boy, we can use every dime in this state. Put it in our roads, right?
Absolutely. So. Yes, fill the potholes with it. But that is a very important battle that's been going on. A lot of people have been saying that we need to level the playing field here, and especially the bricks and mortar folks who are trying to stay alive on the street.
And then for the last 3 years, we've had the option, if you've used any of the major online tax filing systems, that ask for volunteer for you to volunteer that information.
Right. And Gary,
I'm sure you step right up, don't you?
Well,
you know?
Gary has. Gary has very faithfully done that, and more power to
him.
Yeah,
you
notice
he didn't say Ed on that.
By the way, with the auto show going on right now, this is the first public day as we're recording this of the auto show. Self-driving cars, lower-cost navigation systems have been developed out of Ann Arbor.
Well, it's still on the drawing boards, but essentially it doesn't use lasers. Lasers are very expensive, and they use the lasers for the range finding and all that jazz. And so what one of our college guys at the U of M has come up with is using a low-cost video camera and the same software that's used in video games, and it achieves the same results, but for far less.
Awesome. So, I love
that's great.
You know, there's the wonder of technology, that the more that is out, especially in an atmosphere like Ann Arbor, where you have this wonderful University of Michigan, and all of our other university centers around the state, you have that ability to just keep pushing the envelope, and you're going to find a cheaper, faster solution eventually. And this is wonderful existing technology that's being picked up. One other thing I saw down here is, and this is kind of interesting because it's certainly a huge thing. Talk about a facelift. There's a $7 billion facelift coming for the Great Lakes St. Lawrence shipping system.
Well, that's collectively starting from 2009 and rolling forward to 2018. But they're going to be putting in a lot of, they're going to be modernizing the seaway locks. They're going to be doing a lot of intermodal work. In other words, the hardcore infrastructure for the shipping in the state. This comes from a study that came out of Ontario with our Canadian brothers there, you know. But, I mean, it's Michigan alone is going to spend more than $100 million to modernize. And these are all good things because... Like the rest of the infrastructure in this state, it's kind of falling apart. So.
Exactly, and it's something that we've all kind of taken for granted, but it ages like anything else, and we need to keep this up in order to keep that incredibly important waterway open and functioning well. And this is going to be divided between the countries, right, between Canada and the U.S.?
Yeah, and most of it's private. About two-thirds of it is private money being spent, and only a third of it is government money. So the industry is putting its money where its mouth is, I guess.
Well, folks, if you'd like to hear more of these headlines, besides getting hold of some of the audio and video resources, how much will it cost you? Absolutely nothing. All you got to do is go to internetadvisor.net, scroll down the page, and click on the Subscribe Now button, and every Friday, you'll get these headlines and many more along with audio resources and video resources, courtesy of MI Tech News. Mike Brennan, thank you so much, and have a great week.
You too, Foster.
Take care. Well, since 1998, Gary Baker and I have had the pleasure of putting together this Internet Advisor. It's been through a lot of different kinds of formations, and for the last, probably about 10 years in particular, it's held this form of being a two-hour show in which, in the first hour, we tackle some subjects, talk with people, interview people, as we're going to be doing shortly, and then in the second hour, we talk about your problems and answer those questions, and when we're live on the WJR, when we're live on that station, we were able to take your calls, but as it is right now, we're preempted on that station, so we've got many letters that we've gotten, or emails, I should say, over the last week with questions about getting things repaired. And we're going to be talking about them in the second hour of the program. Ed Riddell in studio with me right now. And in this first hour, as I said, often what we do is we tackle some particular issue. And one big one that is coming up in the very near future, Ed, is going to be the FCC's presenting their rulings on controlling the internet, if you will, and access to the internet.
Are they still dragging their feet on that?
Oh, they've been dragging their feet.
That's what politicians do.
Well, this is actually something that has been, there was a set of rulings last year. They were shot down in a court fight by Verizon, and this has been an attempt now to come back and try to handle the matter. So to help us tackle what has been a rather thorny issue is Craig Aaron. He is the president and CEO of FreePress.net. And I want to thank you very much, Craig, for joining us here on the Internet Advisor.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, Craig, to start with, there are a lot of voices out there that are saying, we know what the real problem is and the solution is. So I'm going to ask a rather blunt question. Why should we listen to you to start with?
Well, I guess what you should listen to me is I and my group Free Press have been working on this issue of net neutrality for close to a decade. We're a public interest group. We don't take any money from any of the corporations involved in this fight. We don't take any money from the government, any of the political parties. And we have a long track record and hundreds of pages in the various dockets that have been debating this issue over a long time about what is the best way to protect the free and open Internet. And we think that's with strong net neutrality rules.
Why? I was impressed when I went to look at your organization about how broad the scope is on this thing.
Yeah, and you know, on your homepage, you had an article there, and it's the first time, unfortunately, that I've visited your site, and I found it a very well-written article, very concise, yet nailing the pros and cons of each and the proponents in each, and I was impressed. You educated me very well on that. So, I mean, it's not that much. It's only a one- or two-page article, but you really get down to the nuts and bolts of the issues.
Well, I appreciate that. I definitely urge people to go to freepress.net. We have lots of information there, especially about this issue about net neutrality and other threats to the free and open Internet. But, you know, really what you're getting at is this has sort of been the problem in all these policy debates in Washington over the Internet. Often they're really highly technical. They're obscure. Mm-hmm. You have to be a lawyer to be involved. And, you know, often that's absolutely what the biggest companies want. The more obscure and confusing the debate, the better. Because that sort of keeps the public out in a way. And what's been interesting about this net neutrality issue is the public has actually really started paying attention. And millions of people have contacted the agency. And most of them have essentially said, hey, we really like the Internet. We like how it works. We want to be in control of our own Internet experience. Whatever you have to do to make that happen, do that. And we finally seem to be turning a corner here in 2015 where it looks like the Federal Communications Commission finally might actually listen to all those people and do the right thing.
Well, Craig, what gives you that sense that we're finally turning a corner?
Well, a couple important things have happened, and it's certainly not over, but, you know, we've been talking about this issue since at least 2005. Mm-hmm. The court decision that you referenced, that happened almost exactly a year ago.
Right.
Been a lot of back and forth, and the Federal Communications Commission has been very reluctant to really do anything here, but they saw this incredible public response all through last summer and fall. Eventually, 4 million people contacted the agency. I mean, honestly, we didn't know 4 million people knew what the FCC was, let alone would weigh in on an issue like this. It just never happened before. This was more public comment than they got on any issue in the agency's history. And back in November, right after the election, the president, President Obama, actually came out and said that he thought the FCC should do what's called Title II reclassification.
Right.
That's into that wonky stuff. But it's strong and clear Internet rules, and most importantly, it's the authority for the FCC to step in if and when a big phone or cable company is messing with the Internet. The president came out for a position that's, you know, right in line with the position we've been advocating at Free Press, very clear, very detailed. That really sort of turned this debate on its head, and now we just got news out of the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, that the FCC chairman has indicated that he's changed his mind. And while he was very resistant to doing these net neutrality rules, he's now moving toward doing the rules in line with what the president suggested. So it appears that on February 26th, this agency will likely vote on new rules. Now, the devil's going to be in the details.
Yes.
There's a lot still to be sorted out, but I think they are moving in a public interest direction. Now, Congress is still involved. They have a lot to say. There's some movement from the new leadership in Congress to start meddling with this. We'll see where that goes, and that could really start taking shape in the weeks ahead. But my gut says that we are going to get new net neutrality rules and that they're actually going to be pretty good. And if we'd talked at any time in the last 12 months, I would have probably told you the opposite. So it's been a big turnaround.
So the last defeat was basically trying to reclassify Internet service providers as communication, two-way communication companies. Yeah. So that they would fall under
really
Title II?
The problem was a refusal to do that. And
yeah.
So the whole mess really starts back in the early 2000s when you had this existing law, the 96 Communications Act, the act that governs all of our communications. Was pretty clear that you couldn't discriminate, block websites, things like this. But the FCC, back during the Bush administration, started meddling with this, changing how broadband internet was going to be treated under the law. This was because the cable companies were getting into the broadband business, and they didn't want to be treated with the same kind of regulations that the phone companies had.
Which were pretty strict.
All the way to the Supreme Court.
Craig, excuse me. Pardon me. And that, under the old Title II, which was like controlling electricity and things like that as public commodities, or utilities rather, they were pretty strict in terms of the control they could have over it, right?
Well, so the, basically what Title II does is there's a couple important parts of it. And it was originally written, it has a lot to do with your phone system. And you
right.
can think back you know, to the early days of the internet, and there were things like dial-up internet where you had a lot of choices for different providers. And
right.
the reason you had those choices is because of how the law was written. And what the law said is that your phone company had to share its wires.
Right.
It said that they had to offer a wholesale price, and, you know, AOL and Earthlink and, you know, whoever else we used to have in the dial-up world could get in on the business. It was still just one phone line coming into your house.
Right.
But there was this sort of choice, and we had a lot of choices. Prices went down. When broadband came in, obviously a better technology, cable was suddenly going to be in that business. And they cable had always been under a different part of the law because cable TV was just one-way communications. And so they said to the FCC, they said, we don't want all these obligations. We don't want to share our wires.
Right.
And the FCC agreed with them. And
oh.
they said, okay, you don't have to. We think this might create competition, but we're going to reserve... We're going to basically reserve some things to say, hey, if you do start messing with things, we're going to do something about it. There was a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court essentially said, all right, this doesn't sound like a very good idea to us. In fact, Justice Scalia wrote a particularly scathing opinion saying they shouldn't have allowed the FCC to do this, but they said, you're the expert agency, you do it, and let's see what happened. And then the phone company said, well, wait a minute, if cable doesn't have to play by these rules, we don't want to either. So suddenly, what had been what's called a telecommunication service, two-way communication service, was treated under a different part of the law.
Ah.
It was originally written to govern websites and things like LexisNexis information mm-hmm. services and things like that. And to make the somewhat long story shorter, basically what happened is eventually companies started getting caught interfering with content. So Comcast got caught blocking people's file sharing.
Uh-huh.
The FCC investigated. They tried to sanction Comcast for doing that. Comcast said, well, hey, wait a minute, you don't have the authority. And the courts agreed with them. So the FCC went through several rounds of this, at least two rounds of trying to make rules, but not going back and fixing this original problem. And
okay.
they kept losing in court, because every time they'd make a new rule, a phone company or a cable company would sue them and say, you don't have the authority. So
we're talking, by the way, Craig, hang on a second. We're going to have another section to continue our conversation here, because as you can see, folks, with this little history we've been getting of the battle behind net neutrality, it is very complicated, but somebody's helping us sort it out. That's Craig Aaron from freepress.net. Back with him in just a moment. Thank you for joining us, for bringing us into your home, and for those who are listening to us on our network, we're delighted that you could join us as well. My name is Foster Brown, and Ed Riddell is with me in studio here, my sidekick for today. Well, coming up in February, some important decisions are going to be made at the FCC about rules that will control the way that information is shared and controlled over the internet, how content is dealt with there as well. It is a terribly thorny issue, and we have asked Craig Aaron to be with us. He is the CEO and president of freepress.net. And the reason we've invited him to be on is because this organization, I think, first of all, it's not a partisan organization, not a political arm of or an arm of some party or interest group, other than your interest group and mine, the public's. And they have done a marvelous job over the last decade of sorting out these things. So I want you to treat freepress.net, which you can get to off of our homepage, internetadvisor.net. There's a link there. Click on that. It'll take you straight to their site there, and you're going to find all sorts of resources, including an article that Craig just published called Don't Let Congress and Comcast Derail Real Net Neutrality. And the reason I want to point you back there, and Craig, thank you so much for being on with us again today. We appreciate you being here on the Internet Advisor. Your
organization,
you guys have just gotten a tremendous amount of resources together. As you may have heard, Craig, in about 7 minutes, did a marathon of explaining where we've been and how we got here. And, of course, there are a lot of twists and turns in this. But the bottom line, Craig, is that we have the possibility, and you said this at the outset, you feel now, after all of these years of struggling over this thing, that we are possibly on the cusp of making some real progress towards a net neutrality, which will mean, I believe, it sounds like, that there will be a some way of controlling a freer flow of information over the internet, and that content won't be messed with in the meantime. Am I being simplistic with this?
But no, I think you're pretty close. It's essentially insurance against that happening. It's
yes.
The difference between the free and open internet we know and love, where anybody with a good idea, a new business idea, something yep. important to say, can find an audience and compete with the biggest companies out there, and an internet that's turned into something that looks like cable television, where somebody yeah. else picks and chooses the channels for you, decides what works, starts having tiered pricing, starts creating fast lanes for certain things and slow lanes for the rest of us. That's never been the way the internet's worked. We want to make sure that it keeps working. Net neutrality is a key to doing that. In fact, it's really the key principle that helps create that amazing internet that we have today.
Right, exactly. It's been kind of the Wild West here, Eddie, all along, and this is kind of the civilization of that Wild West.
Well, and then there's just so much innovation out there. I mean, who would have thought that a company like Netflix would
oh,
which,
yeah.
which we thought they have won a number of battles, but those have been reversed or could be reversed in the near future if this does not go forward.
I don't know we ever imagined, Craig, that we would be consuming
so much
over the internet, and it's just growing exponentially.
Yes.
Well, and that's really what we need to be thinking about, and why we need, you know, just some baseline rules of the road, some basic authority, because we don't know what the next great thing is going to
yeah.
be. And if we had locked in the internet 5 or 10 years ago, you know, we never would have seen YouTube. We never would have seen Netflix. We never would have seen these things that we take for granted now. And I happen to be a believer that there's somebody out there in a garage right now
yeah.
or a dorm room somewhere dreaming up some new thing that's going to be indispensable to me 5 years from now.
Exactly.
But I don't know that I actually need it now. So that's
you know,
why we need clear rules, but flexible rules.
It was interesting, Craig, in a news item that was just reported at the start of our program, somebody tinkering at the University of Michigan has discovered a way of using a video camera that's used in video games in place of lasers in some of these car control systems.
Well, yeah, basically, so in replacing the high expensive lasers in the automobiles
yeah.
and using video cameras and software that is used in games to detect, cars in your left, right, behind
yep.
you or forward.
And the other day I was out at IKEA buying a lamp, and suddenly they are literally clearing their shelves right now to bring in the LED lights. Yeah, think of the technology that's come along. As you said, somebody tinkering in their garage, somebody in a lab somewhere is doing something that could impact this whole thing incredibly. And I'm just kind of waiting for that next thing to burst out.
Yeah. So is there, you know, one of the things I read in that article that you said was the wording of, please help me here, Craig, is you know, Comcast and companies like Verizon have put forth a document that they would like to see pushed forward, but basically it's a Trojan horse. It sounds like it's net neutrality, but under the covers, it's really going to, you know, give them carte blanche.
Yeah, it's not neutrality.
Right? Yes.
That's exactly what's happening. This debate has come so far that suddenly people who historically have been opposed to net neutrality and you know, saying there was no need for it, have suddenly, you know, discovered after a few million people spoke up, well, maybe they're for it after all. But
yeah.
You know, as always, in any of these things, legislation, regulations, you know, unfortunately, the devil's in the details, and that's where the problems get created. And so there's some good language in this bill that's probably going to be introduced very soon in Congress, as soon as next week. But there's also a lot missing from it. And really the problem with it is it locks down a very narrow set of protections, but actually strips the regulatory agency of the kind of authority it needs
uh-huh.
to deal with emerging problems.
Yes.
So it essentially locks us in that same way to exactly what we have right now.
Craig, how...
And that's not good for innovation.
How important is it that President Obama spoke out on this? Now, the FCC
hugely
is...
Hugely important.
Yeah,
the leader of the free world paying attention to telecommunications and technology policy makes a really big difference. And, you know, President Obama was actually an early person speaking out on this
yes.
issue back when he was running for office.
Yes.
But then he kind of disappeared for about 6 years on the issue, didn't say much of anything, but he's come in very clearly in the past few weeks, made these internet issues a big priority in his last 2 years, and frankly, it's turned the debate on its head.
Well, and he benefited during his campaigns from the internet, from Twitter campaigns and so many other things. So it's always been kind of strange to me that he has been very quiet until recently on this. So I guess we can look for that. Now, again, folks, we're not going to try to delve into all the details here, but again, hats off to Craig, you, Craig, and to the whole freepress.net site, because there's a wealth of stuff there, folks. Please delve into it in order to be able to inform yourself of what's going on. There's a lot at stake here. I mean, this very program and what we've done for 17 years now is, in many ways, is going to be impacted by what's happening in the FCC. One thing I want you to talk about is what looks like the coming together of monopolies with things like Comcast gobbling up Time Warner.
Yeah, this is the real story in some ways, is the concentration of power over the future of the internet and the real danger of having gatekeepers. And you've got a big company in Comcast that wants to merge with Time Warner Cable. If it does, they'll be the, you know, they're already the biggest cable company in the country, already the biggest internet service provider. But if they can get this deal done, they'll actually control essentially two-thirds of the high-speed connections throughout the entire country, or more than 60%
that can't be good.
Of the cable service, which is a lot of power in the hands of one company. And look, they're also a movie studio. They're also a news organization. They have content that they want to push and prefer.
And
you know, they want you to have to go through them to get what you want.
And they're beholden to their stockholders, not the American public.
Right,
period.
Exactly. And they should do things to advance their stockholders.
Absolutely.
That's why we need
a
counterweight of smart public policy.
Because absolutely.
Often what's in the best and narrow short-term interest of a given company is not in the broader public interest. And look, these guys are going to make plenty of money. They're making a lot of money, 80, 90% profit margins on that cable modem.
Good Lord.
You pay them for every month. But the problem is we don't want them being able to dictate what's going to work on the web, where innovation is going to come from. And
right.
We don't want these innovators out there to have to go get permission from a Comcast or an AT&T or a Verizon before they can develop the next big.
They become enormously.
What we actually want is that even playing field for everybody.
Yeah, they become enormously powerful in our culture, Ed, you know, in terms of what we see, what we know about what's going on, and how we communicate with one another. It's just extraordinarily powerful. Craig, and you've been at this for quite a while, right? Not just the.
At least a decade.
Yeah. Has there ever been a time when you just want to throw your hands up and say, the heck with this? This is just too hairy, too complicated. I am one tiny little David against a whole lot of Goliaths.
Yeah, well, no question about it. Sometimes it gets pretty frustrating. You know, anytime you're dealing with politics and politicians making these kind of crucial decisions, it can get pretty frustrating. But, you know, that's sort of how it's designed, because they hope you won't keep showing up. So, you know, I always remind myself that, look, David wins sometimes. he beat Goliath. He found that slingshot. You know, we have the opportunity. And when people actually get involved, when they actually pay attention, their politicians, their elected leaders will respond, and we can create better, smarter policies that are going to give us more of what we want, lower prices, faster speeds, and the kind of new innovations that everybody benefits from, and in turn, create a stronger economy, create a more vibrant democracy. That's what the internet has done already. I think it can be even greater, and that's what keeps me in there, even when it means going through the footnotes of some FCC order or looking at that army of lobbyists sort of arrayed against what I'm
saying. Oh, dear. Craig, I want to thank you for your noble work over these years. Freepress.net is the site, Craig. Thank you so much. Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Freepress.net. Good luck to you. We'll check in with you this next month as well as the rulings come down. Thanks so much, Craig.
Look forward to it.
All right. That is a very thorny subject, but you can help untangle yourself by going to our website and checking out freepress.net. Welcome. It's the Internet Advisor, Foster Brown, the co-host and producer of the program, along with Mr. Eddie Baker, our tech expert. And,
Eddie Baker.
What is good Lord, there's a combination. Ed Rudell and Gary Baker. I got Eddie Baker out of that. That's very good. Oh, my Lord.
That's okay, Foster.
What a combination that would be.
I was just thinking of morphing our faces together with a GIF generator. Oh, my gosh.
Oh,
that's just
my
awful.
Lord. Ed Rudell in studio, of course. He's our tech expert, and Ed will be handling some of the questions coming up in the second hour of our program. As you probably have realized, this is a special recording we do for our networks. And we're delighted that you folks out in Lansing and Battle Creek and Grand Rapids area, for instance, can hear us. And by the way, I want you to know that we love to hear from you when you have questions about your computers. and getting on the internet and around it. All week long, we're answering questions for people who send us emails. And you do that simply by going to internetadvisor.net, our homepage where the show notes are, and clicking on the Contact Us button. And when you do that, you can then put your question in. And as a matter of fact, we're going to be talking about some of those questions in just a little bit in our second hour. And that's where Ed shines. But Eddie, I saw some things coming out of the auto show, which is going on in Detroit area right now. It's the really big show here. In some ways, this is kind of a follow-up in terms of technology to the Consumer Electronics Show, which already happened. Something I know you're interested in is 3D printing.
Yes. Why? Is there something represented at the auto show?
It certainly is. It's absolutely fascinating. Paul Eisenstein with the Detroit Bureau, who's been our guest here. Lead article in the Detroit Bureau this week was on local motors planning two 3D microplants. Here's how it goes. Local Motors is the name of the company. They are literally 3D printing one of their cars at the show.
Interesting.
Isn't that fascinating? Now, it's an electric car. It's called the Strati. And it's a battery-powered car, obviously. They have micro plants in Phoenix and Las Vegas where they build these things right now, but they're actually going to be downloading and printing and putting together parts of this car right at the auto show.
You know, that is the future of 3D printing right now. We were talking quite a bit last week and the week before about CES, how 3D printing was making such, you know, this is the year of 3D printing. What people don't realize, and I think Gary said it, there are over... what was the number? He said 5,000 different types of plastics that you can use for manufacturing parts. Quite a number of them. But when you're using a 3D printer that with technology that we have right now, you're using the spooled, one type of plastic. Right. You're going to need to have a huge number of plastics. So for hobbyists like ourselves, we're going to be limited in what we can print 3D. And like I always use the example, like if my vacuum cleaner, if a part breaks, you know, that little plastic part that holds the electric cord when you wrap it around, and I cannot find that on the internet. I just want to make something that fits in that hole that I could swing up. And, you know, I could use 3D printing capability to do that. And, but will the plastic be rugged enough? So at some point in the future, manufacturers will not have to store all these fiberglass panels or carbon panels. They could manufacture them to your specs.
Well, that's interesting.
On the fly.
Because Local Motors is doing that exactly on the floor of the show. They're actually producing the full vehicle body. Now, it assembles, after printing out the body, the chassis, and much of the interior. It assembles the remaining components, including the suspension, wheels, and tires, and the powertrain. In other words, it's got those separately, but it brings them all together, and it can do this. But the body is printed. That's the incredible part about it. And the vehicle consists of just 50 components, rather than thousands that are used in the, you know, regular construction of a car. So they're also simplifying the construction. Now, obviously, these are just baby steps.
Yes.
Baby steps. But still, it's mind-blowing that we've gone from, you know, the little dolls that were printed or the little figurines, were the kind of things you'd find in a Cracker Jack box. We're now going to producing these entire cars. But if you get to the auto show, look it up. It's called Local Motors, and they've got a fascinating display going on there. One of the other things that I heard the other day, that came out of CES and now is kind of being played out at the auto show is, Ed, one of the things, I don't know if you've noticed, if you get in one of these fancy cars, it takes forever to try to figure out where all the buttons are. How do you set the volume for this? Where is the control for that?
We are all creatures of habit, and we're used to doing something in a certain way, and you have to re-explore, how did this manufacturer interpret and present so I can have that same type of control?
Well,
you know, I like my windshield wiper on the right-hand side, not the left-hand side. You know, stuff like that.
And even when you're handling, like, displays that are digital, you know, how do I raise or lower the volume, or how do I go to the next icon, et cetera? Well, what's happening now is Apple Play has come out. Apple Play is like a software base behind some of these systems, so that essentially, if you're an iPhone user and you step into these vehicles that have Apple Play, essentially, the display will look like your iPhone, and it'll be easier to get around because you know how to get around your iPhone. The same thing is going to be happening with Android. so that if you're an Android user, you have a, you know, a Nexus phone or whatever it may be, or one of the Samsung phones runs Android, and there's a huge number of them out there, eventually you'll be able to do that again. You say, oh, I know what that is. I know how to get home. I know how to get to this and to get to that because it looks like my phone.
That's a great idea. Instead of an entirely new user interface.
Every time you get into one of these darn things.
Yep. I mean, it's like going from a PC that you've been using, or you've been using the PCs for the last 20 years, and you finally make the decision to go to Mac, and you are dumbfounded.
And that's happened to me, by the way. Yes. I think it was about 8 years ago after I baptized an old Dell laptop that I was using with a cup of tea. I don't know if you remember that. Oh, Lord. And I said, okay, now's my time to make the move. And I went over to the dark side. We kidded about at the time. And I went, I'm using a MacBook Pro right now and have enjoyed that. Although still aspects of that.
But
that I'm
very disorienting at the very
beginning. Oh, yeah. There was a bigger learning curve there than I ever thought there would be, even though it was pretty simple.
But it just works, right?
Well, most of the time.
Yes, most of the time.
Yeah. But the nice thing about this is that essentially now, the future holds for us that it will just work when we get into these cars. We won't have to struggle with that. So that's kind of a neat thing. Now, there's a question that came up from a group called Techonomy, and I'm wondering what your response to this would be. How has your worldview changed, and or how were you spurred to action because of things that have happened with the internet? How's your worldview changed, do you think, because of the things that are going on in the internet?
The things that are going on in the internet, or the information I gather from the
internet? Well, that's the whole, this whole thing has come into our lives.
Yeah, the internet has really broadened my horizon and seen that there's no such thing as a simple decision. And a lot of this you learn as you mature and get older, that you realize there are many different facets that make up a decision, which would then cause, you know, for adults, for us, that's wisdom. Children now have that ability, but they may not be able to use it as well. Right. But they're coming to understand that there's also multiple angles that they can approach a topic or a decision, and they're learning it at a much younger age because there's so much more information out there. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes it. That's perfect. That's fascinating. I would not have thought of that, but the kids now are being given the kind of tools that we as adults grew into. But with the internet, you're presented with so much more.
Time is compressed now for children.
Oh, man.
And for us, it would have taken 25 years to develop in wisdom. They're getting in 5 or 10 years because of the amount of information that's presented to them. Are they mature enough to handle it? You know, that's questionable.
I think my world view has changed to some extent because I'm in contact with more people and get to know more people's perspective on life than I ever would have before.
That's another excellent point.
All right. How has your worldview changed because of the internet? Kind of an interesting question to answer. Well, speaking of questions to answers, that's what Ed's going to do. And I'm going to help him in this next hour. We're going to be taking the questions you presented us here on the Internet Advisor by sending your emails to us through the Contact Us button on our homepage at internetadvisor.net. We'll be back to handle those questions and get some answers for you as well with the second hour of the Internet Advisor. Please stay tuned for that. You're listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor Show. If you want to see the show notes for this program, visit our homepage at internetadvisor.net. That's where you'll also find past podcasts, our toolkit full of free software to clean up your computer and keep it running strong, and other resources. If you have a question for our hosts, just click the contact form on the homepage or enter our forums and place your question there. You can also friend us on Facebook. Now let's get back to the second hour of the Internet Advisor Show podcast. Welcome to hour number two of the Internet Advisor. If you just joined us, we're going to be taking some of the questions that you have presented us during the week through email, and we're going to be doing our very best with Mr. Ed Rudell, our tech expert in studio here, to answer those questions for you and to open up a few other resources that will help you hopefully make your experience on your computer and on the internet a whole lot more pleasurable. So stick around. We've got some answers for your questions coming up in this second hour of the Internet Advisor. Welcome to this hour number two of the Internet Advisor. Kind of, I think from my point of view, the one that's the real gold for you folks who are users out there. Our objective over these, well, since 1998, has been to, in simplest terms possible, make the internet accessible to you. So that people have, and in your computers as well, obviously. that when people have been having problems, to try to find out what those problems are and get them handled. And we've been joined by some great tech folks in here, people who've had their hands on machines, in machines, and have been helping to service them for a long time. And with me today is Mr. Ed Rudell.
Sometimes through machines when you punch them.
That's true. Otherwise, dropkick them to the goalposts of life. Ed's in here to help answer some of the questions that we've received this week. Now, normally, we would have folks who would be calling in right now if we were on our live broadcast on WJR, which is our flagship station out of Detroit. But on occasions, we're preempted by sports programming there. We still continue every week to do our program. That's because on a regular basis, people are sending us their questions via email. And they do that by going to internetadvisor.net, our homepage, and then clicking on the Contact Us button and sending us their concerns. And we do our very best to get back to them and answer those questions. And what we're going to do this week, Ed, is to dig into some of those questions right here on the air.
Excellent.
Now, before we do that, though, you ran across something that you think is going to be very, very important for people in particular who have moved into the world, and many of them are now, grudgingly. You got to heel tracks in the dust as they're moving that way. Moving into Windows 8.1.
Yes. And one of if you will call it, the problems with Microsoft Windows in the past is that its backup strategy was always based on its Microsoft server terminology or technology. And the backup wasn't the best in the world. Mm. I mean, what happens if your computer crashed and it was no longer bootable? You know, the backup media, how do you actually restore your media? Well, with Windows 8 and Windows 8.1, Microsoft has provided a number of backup utilities, but they changed all the names.
I love it, didn't you? Oh.
They changed all the names, they changed all the terminology, and people that, you know, you get to a certain point, we don't like change. I mean, Windows 8 was enough, but now you got, and it's no longer called backup, it's called history.
Oh, okay. Lord.
So thanks to the kudos to WindowsSecrets.com, Fred Langa, Fred has written this letter, and I subscribe to it, and it's a free subscription that I received, and as you know, when I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I drink Dusakis, right? No, when I don't always read his newsletters, but what I do, I read Fred Langa, you know, because I get him in there weekly. Very good.
By the way, the newsletter is called Windows Secrets, and you can go to windowssecrets.com to find that. We'll have a link on our homepage. Matter of fact, we have a link to the whole backup strategy that's already on the homepage there, and that'll take you to the newsletter called Windows Secrets. It's called Windows Backup Tutorial by Fred Langa.
Yes.
That'll take you to the newsletter, and you can. It's really well worth it. For years, we've read these.
Yes, we've read these. We've had him on the air with us once or twice, and he's done a great job breaking down what Microsoft's thinking was and what backup strategies they've provided. Something called you still have the Windows System Restore capabilities, but Windows 8 Backup and Restore is now underneath File History. Of course, Microsoft provides you and File History allows you the ability to back up to a external USB drive or a network drive if you're at home or at work. And why didn't they just call it Microsoft Backup? And that's what Fred gets into in his newsletter. Microsoft, of course, gives you free internet storage with OneDrive. Used to be known as Microsoft. Oh my gosh, I'm drawing a blank. What did OneDrive used to be called?
Oh Lord, it's changed names.
It's
so
changed
often.
So often.
SkyDrive, I think.
SkyDrive.
It was
SkyDrive. Yes. And because of litigation and lawsuits and name rights, they had to change it to OneDrive. So that provides you the ability to synchronize all your data to the cloud, if you will, with free storage that Microsoft provides. And if you're an Office 365 subscriber, you get additional storage, practically unlimited backup strategy. And Fred goes into how to configure it so that it does real time syncing and live copies. And the ability to, access the information from the cloud only or synchronize it with data on your computer.
Oh, I like that, because I have found in the past sometimes with some of these cloud strategies, you got them in both places. So I thought I was freeing up space in my hard drive.
Yes.
Because I got the whole file here and the whole file there, which I don't necessarily want.
Right. And the other third thing that Fred actually thinks of as or calls backup strategy, but what Microsoft calls it is refresh or reset. And and that is the ability of within Windows 8.1, when you say it crashes or whatever, Microsoft's provided the ability to restore it to factory defaults. You're no longer reliant on the manufacturer to do this for you. It's integrated in the in the operating system itself. Mm-hmm. You have the ability to do a refresh, which is restore Windows operating system to a functional state. You won't lose your data. You'll probably lose any programs that you've added and any customizations, but you'll be functional, which is great.
And at least most of your files there when you do the
yes.
when you do the refresh. Now, the reset, however,
that's like that wipes everything and puts it back to out-of-the-box experience.
But the nice thing about that, as you said, is you can do that right from a screen on your computer.
Correct.
When you get into a mess, you can get to that screen, and he goes in to show you how to do that.
Exactly. And he did a great job breaking it down. So kudos to him, because even I was confused on it. When my son, when it started college a couple of years ago, he had the first Windows 8 system. I'm supposed to be up in this technology. I was still rebelling against it, like many of our listeners were. And I'm like,
yes.
Why would Microsoft change its name?
You know? Here's the important thing, folks, for those of you who have Windows 8.1. And by the way, coming up on January 21st, or maybe it's already past that for those of you who are listening to this, Microsoft announced Windows 10. And that's the next stage, but it will still benefit from many of these things. So go to internetadvisor.net and take a look at that link that we posted there about Windows Backup Tutorial by Fred Langa. Listen, we've had something happen here on the show that hasn't happened in a long time. I don't think it's the first time, but Annie Nichols is actually behind the wheel. She's our engineer who stepped in. Thank you. She's helping us with this program. Eric Dorsch, thank you so much for also handling the phones back there. I want to acknowledge the people behind the glass, because if they ever stop doing their job, there will be the sounds of silence here. I'm Foster Brown. Ed Rudell in studio with me. We're handling the questions that you folks send us throughout the week and past few weeks. And this is a big part of our what we do here is answer people's questions. How we started was answering people's questions back in 1998, Gary and I, on my then morning program on WJR in Detroit. Now we're part of this network and a podcast as well. So, Eddie, I got something here that I haven't had in a long, long time.
A free meal?
That too. This is a letter.
A typed
physical
letter?
Physical typed letter. It wasn't handwritten. It was typed, at least, from a gentleman in Toledo, Ohio, Bill. And, Bill, we're very thankful. I don't know if you'll ever hear this, but we'll also get some answers back to you by snail mail as well, so that you're helped. But he sent us a letter, and in it he has this question. When I go online, at the bottom of the page on the screen, it says, Internet Explorer blocked this website from displaying content with security certificate errors. Then it says a problem with this web page caused the Internet Explorer to close and reopen the tab. That's the first problem. Then he said there's another one. Internet Explorer has stopped working. A problem caused the program to stop working correctly. Windows will close the program and notify you if a solution is available. Windows never tells me of any solution for the problem, which is one of the most annoying things about it.
It is.
And he says, do you have any ideas to help fix this problem?
Yes. Okay. I have five off the top of my
okay.
head. So one of the things that I always like to do is I always like going into my, well, we're assuming that he's running, because he said that he purchased the computer at 12/12/12. So we're assuming he's running Windows 7, possibly Windows Vista, hopefully not Windows XP. And I always go in and customize my desktop, and you know, you right mouse click on it and you go to the backgrounds, and I always select the ability to have an Internet Explorer icon on the desktop, as right. opposed to me dragging and dropping and creating my own shortcut there.
Ah.
And one of the reasons for that is if you do that, you can right mouse click on that icon and select the ability to start Internet Explorer with no add-ons.
I did not know that.
Right. And I believe you can do it in XP, but I'm not. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I was working on one this morning. So
okay.
you can, with Internet Explorer 8 or 9, you had that ability. But you
so
can't
again,
do
again
it with
that,
shortcuts.
Okay, good. So the idea is you have to go into properties, isn't it? On the display. Go to the display.
Yeah, yes. Or you can actually right mouse click on the start
okay.
button. And if you have an Internet Explorer icon there, yeah. or start programs Internet Explorer.
Right. But you want to make sure you're using the icon that's part of the operating system, not just a copy that
exactly.
you're putting on the homepage.
And so okay. you right mouse click on it and select start Internet Explorer with no add-ons. Because more than likely what's happened is his Internet Explorer has either been hijacked, the homepage, yep, or an add-on program has been added to it. So when every time he launches Internet Explorer, an add-on piece of software is trying to direct him to maybe a bogus search site or a fraudulent, or what's the term I'm looking for? No. Hostile.
Yeah, yeah.
Hostile, right, website. And Internet Explorer ain't having nothing to do with that. It recognizes that the certificate is bad.
Okay.
And it stops it. That's the first.
Yeah, that security certificate is the kind of thing that is the hint that something's going wrong. Internet Explorer recognizes they don't match.
Correct. Boom. And it's stopping it. And then the program doesn't like it, this add-on program. So it's basically trying and trying and trying and basically crashes Internet Explorer.
I got you.
Okay. So that's probably what's happening. So you can launch Internet Explorer with no add-ons. And then you can, when you do that, Internet Explorer will probably function. You'll probably still receive the original error message that you are going to maybe if your homepage has been hijacked, you know, you may still get a certificate error. But go in there, and there's so many different variables. First, you want to download and install Malwarebytes from malwarebytes.org and let it scan. Download and install it. Scan your computer. It'll probably discover these fraudulent add-ons that attach.
And you can
themselves.
Find the links, by the way, to malwarebytes.org in our toolbox, which you'll find our toolkit,
correct,
which is on our homepage.
You want to go even further, you can go within Internet Explorer and disable the add-ons. So
yes,
select Tools, Add-on Manager, and then you can deselect all your add-ons or.
Am I right that in later versions of Internet Explorer, and this has been some of the problem in some ways, they stopped allowing add-ons? You can't have extensions, am I right, in like Internet Explorer 11? 10, 11? 11, I think it is?
Not that I'm aware of. That's what a toolbar is.
Oh, okay.
Is an add-on program.
Okay, but they're not extensions.
Like
you can have with Google and with Safari and some of the other ones.
That's true.
Now,
the other thing is you also, and this is probably where you're going, you always want to have an alternate browser.
That's it, I was going to say.
Go ahead.
One of the things we always say when you start, if you're limited to one browser, you can be hobbled. You can not be able to get to the internet because of a problem that may only be in that one browser. And it's also a great way to troubleshoot what's going on with the browser by having one or two other ones. I have, I think, maybe four on my computer. I don't use them all, but I have them there as backup. So I will have, for instance, right now I have on my Mac, I have Chrome, and I have Safari.
Yep.
And I have the ability to get to Opera as well if I wanted to. But between Chrome and Safari, and I also have Firefox. So I have the three of them on there.
Correct.
If you're running Internet Explorer, just put one other one on there, like Chrome. Or if you want, Firefox.
Sure, Mozilla Firefox. Yeah.
And there's even a Safari out there that will work within the Windows environment. But the key thing is, when you have another browser, you can open that up and see if the same thing begins to happen. If it doesn't, bingo. You immediately identified the problem.
Correct. And that something has been damaged or corrupted with that, with your current browser. Now, another thing that I always like, that you can always do, especially with Internet Explorer, if you're unable to fix it with Malwarebytes and you're unable to right mouse click on the desktop icon and select run with no add-ons, is you can always go into the control panel and programs and features, and then you'll see that Windows Internet Explorer has been updated. You can uninstall. You'll see Internet Explorer there. You're probably running Internet Explorer 11 or 10. You can uninstall the current version. You just uninstall it. Don't worry. If you're running Windows 7, you probably have five different versions of Internet Explorer that have been installed on there.
Now, how
so
do you
could subsequently go in there and say uninstall Internet Explorer. It'll uninstall Internet Explorer 11. You're back to 10.
I got you.
You should be able to launch it.
Now, Ed, do you have to go into? I know on the left-hand side of the control panel, there's a thing you click on there that says to get to
Windows
Elements.
Windows
program
or view installed updates or I think that's what
he's digging for. It's Windows Program Elements, I think it is. That's where you'll then see the Internet Explorer in there, and I think you uninstall it from that point.
Yeah, you can either uninstall a program or uninstall an installed update. This is for Windows 7.
Right.
And you may find, if you don't see it in the programs list, you may see it in the updates list.
Ah, okay. But I was thinking of, I think there's a reading there on the left-hand side of control panel that allows you to also get at some of the Windows Program Elements, like Internet Explorer, and you can uninstall it, reboot the machine, and then, if I'm not wrong, it simply reinstalls.
Nope. It doesn't reinstall it, actually. During your next Windows update cycle, when it's scanning for security updates, it'll download another the newest version, but you'll be running the previous versions of Internet Explorer. I've done this on a computer and actually uninstalled 3 or 4 subsequent updates of Internet Explorer, like I said, going from 11, 10, 9, and back to 8, and then back to 7 eventually.
Which was the one that worked best, wasn't it? Was it 8 that worked best or 9 that worked best with Windows 7? I'm trying to think back to that.
Okay,
we're drawing a blank on it. Yeah. But there were some that were optimized for Windows 7 in particular. Going on from there, heaven help us, it seems to be they keep on updating them. By the way, there's a new thing happening. We're going to hear about it next week. A brand new browser developed by Microsoft called Spartan.
Called what?
Spartan, I believe. We're going to find out more about that this next week. We're going to have some folks in from Microsoft. Back in just a moment to handle some more of the questions that have come in to us here on the Internet Advisor. I like this format, Ed. It's kind of fun sitting around here talking about computers with Mr. Ed Rudell.
It's just a one-on-one, you and me.
I love it. You and I and the questions. In case you've just kind of joined us here, what we're doing is talking about questions that people have sent in to us. And trying to get some help for them. We did stumble, as we were coming out of the last segment, stumbled on something that is going to be made official on January 21st. If you happen to be listening before then, after then, we'll have, matter of fact, we're going to have a whole bunch of people from Microsoft in our studios on January 21st. And we're going to be talking with them at that time about all the things that will be revealed on January 21st.
Oh, yeah, I have to tell them it's going to be that's my birthday, so they have to give me presents.
Oh, yes, I will tell them to bring, browsers. I mean, Surface Pro 3s and things like that. Just throw them at you.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, I love that.
Throw them at my feet, please.
And on the 21st, they're going to be announcing Windows 10 preview now for the general consuming public.
Excellent.
I've been working with it for about 4 months. I love it. It works really wonderfully. I love the start page on the thing, and there have been some screenshots of that, where you don't come into that big, Cal would call the Fisher-Price look, where you've got these colorful squares.
You have a modified start menu that includes the left-hand column is the traditional, but then it does have the larger Fisher-Price tiles on there.
Yeah, which are nice, because you can only put the ones that you want in there.
Exactly.
And there's mail and whatever else it may be that you use on a regular basis. Anyway,
so
one of the things that was just revealed this last week was by Mary Jo Foley, who was a person who was kind of an insider and a commentator on Windows and Microsoft in general, is that there's a brand new browser coming to Windows 10.
Microsoft's coming out with a new browser.
A new browser. So Internet Explorer will not be the first thing you get there.
You know, this makes perfect sense. And they have to do this. The Internet Explorer that they provided with Windows 8 was terrible with the address bar at the bottom. And this may be that way.
Crazy.
It was crazy. But think of all the history that Internet Explorer has. Think of all the libraries of data that hackers have on all the holes that have been discovered over all the years. If Microsoft just says, boof, we're going to get rid of it, we're starting a new browser, they throw out those libraries, they start again.
And that's a beauty.
And it won't be as large of a target. I like it.
Among other things. But here's the cool thing. All right, all of you MSU fans out there, the new name is Spartan.
Really?
That is the new name that has been leaked. That's the code name that's been used in the development.
Spartan as in sparse or spare?
Well, it's supposed to look a lot like Chrome. The Chrome browser is, compared to the other ones, a pretty Spartan or sparse-looking space, not all the bells and whistles that have come along with a lot of browsers. And this one is called Spartan. We'll see what it is.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that it's going to be the default browser that's there. However, apparently you can also go back and get the Windows 11, I believe it is.
I hope they choose a different color other than blue to represent the icon. Really?
Yeah.
Blue screen of death. Internet Explorer's the blue icon. Get rid of the blue, guys.
Paisley, anything.
Yeah.
But folks, we'll have more to say about that on our January 21st program when we have some folks in from Microsoft. We'll be talking about that and a whole lot more coming up. Okay. One of our next emails came from an old friend of ours, Cindy Lobb, out in Westland. And here was her message. She said, I had the hubby's laptop on today, and suddenly the screen went dark. I thought it was sleeping, like hubby who's on the couch.
Yeah.
I don't know. I added that. That wasn't in there. Okay. But it but it wouldn't wake up. So I hit the power button, and it came up with the Dell sign. And then it said it was scanning the C drive and stuck. at 48%. So I hit the power button again. Now it says, no boot device found. Da-da-da-da. Press any key to reboot the machine. I hit any key. It tries to reboot, and I get the same message. Powered off again, took out the battery, turned it on. Now it says, repairing disk errors. This may take over an hour to complete. And that was 50 minutes ago, and the wheel of death is still spinning.
Well, if it's going to take an hour or more to fix, and it was only 50 minutes ago, she still has 10 minutes. No. So this is the classic symptom of a hard drive that is either failing, right? So you got a failing hard drive where you're actually getting disk errors, or what you're getting is corrupted Windows files, which is different. It's NTFS file system errors. Mm. So you can have corrupted files on your computer, or you can have damaged disk drive. They're kind of hard to discern which is which.
So one is the mechanical drive itself is failing.
Yes. And the other one is that for some reason maybe the head skipped on something, or a file became corrupt because, you know, who knows?
Computer got bumped?
Bumped. Yeah.
And little needles.
But even that is like a disk corruption too.
Yes.
But you should let the disk scan complete. If it doesn't, what are you going to need? You're going to need another hard drive. You're going to have to get a new computer.
News is those things are cheap.
Yeah,
cheap.
But how they get the data off here, and that's where we talk about that Heron's Boot CD or bootable flash drive. So if you go to the InternetExplorer.net website, and in the toolkit, we have a section in there called Live CDs.
InternetAdvisor.net.
What am I saying?
Explorer.
InternetAdvisor.net.
I don't know where you get it if you go to Internet Explorer.
I was thinking three steps ahead. And you can... You can create a live or bootable CD.
Yeah.
So you're booting off of the CD or the flash drive instead of booting off of your hard drive. Mm-hmm. And that'll allow you to then navigate and get to your data.
Can I ask you to stop for a second? Because you've mentioned this a number of times. When you say you're booting off of something, let's just take one step back. What does that mean?
So every time you power up your computer, your computer is loading from a physical disk drive.
The
hard drive on your computer.
Right.
And it loads everything from the hard drive into the memory of the computer.
Right.
Most computers nowadays are shipping with 4 or 8 or more gigabyte of silicon memory or memory, right? And your hard drives are coming with 500 gigabyte or a terabyte of disk drive space or hard drive space,
right?
So it's loading it from the hard drive to the memory.
Okay.
And that's where the operating system loads. You know, one's long-term storage, the other one's short-term storage.
Now, when you have a bootable device then, like you plug a USB that's bootable.
Or a CD-ROM that's
or
bootable.
Or put a CD-ROM in that's bootable. What's that doing?
Well, if your computer is configured properly, and it usually is from the manufacturer, it's usually configured to always boot from the DVD and CD drive first, then it checks for your USB drives, and then it'll check your hard drive.
Right.
So if you have a bootable media in there, you have the ability to, it'll ask you, do you wish to boot off of this
media?
So
quite simply, folks, when you hear he had talking about bootable, and I just wanted to take a moment, that means that you start the computer from that USB drive when the main hard drive is damaged.
Right. And most manufacturers give you the ability, except now that we're running Windows 8, none of them do this by default. But if you're running Windows 7 and Vista and all previous operating systems, most manufacturers let you tap the escape key to boot from. If you're running gateways, it's the escape key and that'll give you the ability to boot to a different source other than the hard drive. Mm-hmm. If you're running Dells, it's F2.
Is F2, okay.
Or F12.
12, I thought.
If you're running HPs, it's F9. You know, so most manufacturers gave you the ability to choose what you want to boot from, your original hard drive or something else.
Okay.
And what this allows you to do is boot to an operating system that's on this media so that you can navigate and see if your hard drive's there. And then maybe I can copy it off of two.
Right. Now,
an external hard drive.
Right. This is kind of like a salvage operation
at
this
point. Salvage.
Oh,
good phrase.
Yeah. Because what you want to do then is to get your most important files if you haven't been backing up.
Yep.
To get them off safely. Now, if you've been backing up all along, you don't have to worry about
it. Right, it's time to get a new computer or take that one into the shop.
Exactly.
$50, $100, you get a new hard drive plus labor. You'll be out of there.
Hard drives are so cheap nowadays.
Yeah.
500 gig hard drives are running for $50-$75.
All of these people that, a lot of listeners that are still running Windows XP, you have to realize your computers are approaching 8 years old, if not more. And those hard drives, you know, are only limited to spin for like 5 to 7 years.
And while you may have thought, well, it's still working for me, bless God, the hard drive has been doing a lot of work for you, a lot of spinning, et cetera, and it's a mechanical device, and it will wear out eventually. And right now, it is just the price of hard drives is ridiculously cheap. But in addition to that, if you have the money, it's also time to step up to a new machine.
Yep, and they're becoming so much, and it's maybe a laptop.
Yep.
Instead of getting a desktop, I have people that refuse to get anything other than a desktop because they had these monitors, but they're still the square flat screen monitors. You can go with a large landscape, or widescreen version of those. Heck, even now, I had a person that's finally bought, he says, well, they made a compromise. So instead of buying a laptop, what they decided to do is they bought themselves another desktop, but it supported HDMI. And now they're using their old 32-inch TV that they don't really use anymore because they upgraded to a 60-inch. So they have a 32-inch
monitor
TV connected up to their computer, and that's their primary device.
That is great. I what I use is a laptop, but then I hook it up to a 22-inch monitor in front of me. And that's where I do most of my work. Mm-hmm. And then I have the laptop off to the side, which has some of the other programs on it. So lots of ways of getting around that issue. Okay, Cindy, hope we helped you with that. And we'll be back to tackle some more things. For instance, about DoubleClick, a nasty little virus that's out there, and some other things that people needed help with. Well, proving she's not just another pretty face, Annie Nichols has done a great job engineering our program.
Did she just throw something at the screen, at the glass? I think she did.
One finger, two? No, okay. And Eric Dorsch has also been helping us with screening the calls. Thank you so much for helping us behind the scenes. I'm Foster Brown. Ed Rudell is our tech expert in studio here. We've had kind of our own Spartan version of the program here. Hope you've enjoyed it. By the way, show notes are at internetadvisor.net, but heck, you got here through the podcast, so you know they're there, and you've been able to find the other resources that we put up there as well. Coming up on January 21st, very special show. We're going to be doing one entirely dedicated to Microsoft and some of the big changes. And as we said before, the rumor is, and it's becoming more and more firm, that the new Windows 10 will be loading with a brand new, completely from the ground up, brand new browser called Spartan. So all of the Michigan State fans out there will be happy with that.
Well, that's the code name. So
that's the code name that they have out there.
Any dibs on what they're going to really call it?
That'll be interesting. A formal brand name has yet to be announced. But Microsoft is potentially considering discarding Internet Explorer completely. So what's going to happen is Windows 10 comes out. It'll have this brand new stripped down, very much looks like Chrome or Firefox in the sense of that very clean look. And then there'll be a backwards compatible version of Internet Explorer 11 there for those who want that.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a feeling people are going to really dig this. I hope it works that way. But one thing I didn't know is that Internet Explorer turns 20 this August.
That makes sense because it came out with Windows 95.
Yep.
And the Internet Explorer, and I forgot what the version
number was. Remember the stink that came out when it came out?
Yes.
Because it was shipped with the operating system, and it was, we've got no other alternatives.
We all wanted to use Netscape.
That's right.
We had Netscape with Windows 3.1.
And it was a big battle that went on, a monopoly battle, et cetera. Anyway, it's kind of interesting that 20 years later, they're going to be launching this brand new browser, and it'll be very interesting to see what goes on with it. As you said very wisely before, it'll be also unloading all of the baggage that was there for hackers to pick into.
Mm-hmm.
It's a clean interface and be very interesting to see.
Take bets on they're going to call it Windows Phoenix.
Ooh.
Rebirth from the ashes.
Right? Oh, all right. We got bets down, folks.
Okay.
Okay, here's another question that came in from Dorothy. I'm getting a lot of emails in one of my mailboxes that says, it's from me. When I right-click on the show full headers, it said, it's from my email address. The emails are selling all sorts of things. How do I stop them? I tried to block my own email address, but it would not let me do that. But it will let me block in the filter box. Will that stop just the emails from me, like these bogus ones, or will it block all of my emails?
Well, that, I don't think that's the way to do it. There's four things that you should do. First is change your password. Change your internet or your email password, which is usually tied to your, it may be your internet service provider. So if you have Comcast, work with Comcast on changing your password, or go to their home site and go through the user preferences and find out how to change your password. If you're using Yahoo or Google or Microsoft Outlook.com, mm-hmm. they also provide the ability for you to change your password.
Right.
That's the first step.
Right. Somebody has obviously hijacked, maybe not your address list, but somebody else's address list.
Well, she could have
had your name on her.
Yes, yes. And the other thing is that scan your computer with antivirus software and malware, anti-malware software like Malwarebytes from malwarebytes.org. Can you think of anything else, Foster, besides?
No, the changing your email password right away is the first one, you know, and don't panic. I think that probably it's simple, but it's a basic one. And then make sure that fixes the problem for you.
And if that doesn't work, you're going to have to contact your internet service provider.
She's with AT&T.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think she probably can go in there and reset the
password. And I'm surprised. I mean, and if she's using AT&T's email, which is Yahoo, I'm surprised they haven't contacted her and said that her mailbox is spewing out tons of spam.
Mm.
You know, remember my box in Internet Advisor was taken over.
That's right.
For a short period of time. And I was contacted right away
mm-hmm.
by our ISP.
Yeah.
And first thing they said, change your password, and the problem stopped.
Boom. All right. Let's move on to another one then. This one comes from Kevin. And he's a Gmail client. And he says, I have a Gateway laptop with Windows 7 and an Intel Core i3. Nice little laptop. Came with Realtek HD audio. And even though I have maxed up the volume controls and the equalizer settings, most videos I watch don't have enough volume to hear unless the room is dead silent. I usually have to raise each video's individual settings as well. I've had this problem from the beginning. I've updated the Realtek driver using Driver Booster 2, but it was no help. Please advise.
Well, it sounds like he was trying to do what my first suggestion would have been, which is this has been an ongoing issue from Microsoft since Windows 95, and that is there is no master volume control. There is a volume control that Microsoft calls the master volume control, but you have to remember, if you're watching YouTube videos or watching web-based videos, each one of those have their own individual volume control.
Even on my Mac, I've noticed that.
Yes, and independent of the Microsoft volume control. If Microsoft was wise, they would have tied them all together or forced the software companies to comply, like Java-based mm-hmm. video browsers ActiveX video browsers. So you have to go into every website that you could think of that you would watch video, and even check all the programs on your computer. Like Microsoft has, QuickTime. Maybe you haven't seen a QuickTime movie in a long time. Do you remember the last time QuickTime players have actually launched on your computer?
No. Well, on a Mac, PC? So they
probably does on a Mac.
A little more on a Mac.
On a PC, not that frequently.
No, not freaking all.
So, and you'll find that the QuickTime has its own volume controls as well. So you have to launch every application, even the sound recorder, QuickTime.
Right. All independently controlled.
Microsoft Silverlight also is Microsoft's attempt at ActiveX or Flash version of the audio video controls. You have to launch every application and max them out.
Basically. And what would you think of in a situation like this? Maybe for troubleshooting at least, but maybe as a solution, he took the Realtek solution. Well, which probably came with the computer. And you're shaking your head like,
yeah, it's not going to work.
No. How about this? Downloading VLC as a player, the free audio video player,
possibly.
And using that to play?
It depends what he's watching. Would VLC launch if you're watching YouTube on a web?
That's a good question.
Yeah. See, the other thing that, so I gave them my primary suggestion we just talked about. The other thing that you could try is Microsoft Fixit. Microsoft has a website that has all their Microsoft Fixit apps there. This was first started where Microsoft would have a very, would identify very common problems, numerous people reporting the problems, and they'd provide a Fixit app to fix the problem. Instead of giving the users the instructions, say, go open up the registry editor, or open up this location and make
is
this
that the
fix.
Little guy with the blue hat and everything else?
So Microsoft has provided a page for Microsoft Fixit that should take care of it. And if you search through the Fixit thing, they actually have a volume control fix for audio playbacks.
Nice.
So Microsoft. So, anyways, that was the other suggestion. I sent him the link, and you could just search for Microsoft Fixit, and you'll be taken to that page.
So, in general, when people are having problems with a Windows-based machine, one of the things they can do to look for some common solutions would be to go to the support.microsoft.com.
Correct.
And then in the search box there, put in whatever the thing happens to be that they're having trouble with, and see if there's a Fixit that can help them.
Exactly.
And the wonderful thing about that, folks, is that you just click on that, download it to your computer, and it goes to work.
Yes.
Behind the scenes, takes care of it, makes sure you're done, and then says goodbye.
Exactly.
I love it. Well, I hope you've loved this show, enjoyed it. We'll be back with our live program on January 21st. And as they say, God willing, the creek don't rise. For Eddie Riddell and myself, Foster Brown, we've had a wonderful week here. And look forward to this coming one. A big one for Microsoft as they are going to be launching a whole lot of stuff, including that brand new browser called Spartan for all of you Michigan State fans. Be happy for maybe be green and white instead of blue. Thank you to all the engineers who have made the program possible. I see Rich has stepped back in to wrap things up. Rich Lozinski, thank you. And for the rest of you, don't forget, go to internetadvisor.net for our show notes and for continuing information. And send us your problems there.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisors Show, the longest-running, locally produced computer show in Detroit radio. If you'd like to find out more about our weekly show, ask a question of our experts, or find the show notes for this podcast, visit internetadvisor.net. And you'll also find us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.